and presence. And I would like to thank the conveners, the Pope Francis as well, for convening us in this extraordinary venue, which is certainly lent a aura of enchantment to our conference. I took a degree in philosophy and theology here 37 years ago, and like no other place that I know in the modern world, Oxford still has all the magic that it had at that time. It has really been a great pleasure. Now, it feels like we're at the end, but I don't intend to let us off easy after it. One more effort. It might seem as if I'm trying to recapitulate the entire conference from Empedocles to Paul Celan. A lot of what's been talked about over all these days is condensed somewhere in what I want to present to you now. So, I do beg your indulgence here and ask for your effort. My purpose, in some sense, is to instill an acute sense of what is at stake in poetry today and in any age, of what constitutes its universal value and highest calling. And this highest need to be nothing less than prophetic revelation of theological truth, or more broadly expressed, disclosure of the deepest meaning of life and being in history as a whole. This has been poetry's vocation since time immemorial. It could and perhaps should still hold true, even in our techno-fetishistic times of spectacular forgetting of our source and origin, and of the poetry whose very reason for being is the sounding of that enigma. To this end, I propose a panoramic vision of poetry, beginning from its anthropological origins in orgiastic rites, religious cults, and sacred dance, as well as in divination, magic spells, and incantations. The end point of this trajectory is the postmodern apocalypse of poetry that witnesses to the obliteration of fixed and stable meaning in indeterminacy. In this apotheosis, the meaning of poetry expands to infinity and explodes, or implodes. As determinate meaning collapses, however, a plenum of sheer presence or absolute being in the incarnate word is free to emerge into its own. This apocalyptic event gives rise to reflection. It is the culmination of the history of poetry as one of increasing self-reflection. Such an historical reflection passes through the speculations of Plato and Longinus, Renaissance and Baroque treatises on rhetoric, romantic defenses of poetry, modernist poetic manifestos, and more. These are all different angles of approach that can illuminate poetry's high prophetic calling. Now, I think a place to begin is with the word, the Latin word, vates, for prophet, and indistinguishably for poet. The two overlap and interpenetrate. They completely coalesce in many of their functions and modalities. The same goes for the Sanskrit word kavi. And although it's not necessarily cognate, it sounds that way. Navi in Hebrew has the same connotation. It's the word for prophet. But I think the literal meaning is to bubble forth as from a fountain, which suggests the fecundity of poetic imagination and creativity, such as is manifest in Amos and Isaiah, Elijah, Ezekiel, producing parables, proverbs, and even love songs. So in primordial cultures worldwide, with only minimal social stratification and differentiation of roles, long before any mantles as either prophet or poet can be donned and identified, a figure like that of the shaman, or even the wizard, Merlin, amalgamates such functions and offices. These figures are emblematic of a certain undecidability between religious revelation and poetic invention or creativity. And of course, in modern cultures, then, with their highly differentiated social roles, theological revelation and poetry are typically seen as distinct and even become opposed to each other in many ways. But I think we still need to try and understand them as reciprocal and symbiotic in their origins, aims, and functions. Throughout history, the deepest intents of literary and religious practices remain inseparable from each other in their myriad manifestations within our cultural traditions and institutions. Thus, they stand to be illuminated by such a juxtaposition of the revelatory and the rhetorical. Poetry and prophecy together comprise the common matrix of some of the oldest and most fundamental modes of expression of humanity across cultures. The primary source texts of religion across traditions, the Bible, the Quran, the Confucian classics, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, these are all works of insuperable literary genius, as well as being the sources of religion. Poetic form is equally crucial to the great variety of mythopoetic and ritualistic works in folk epics, in national legends, the West African by Yachida, the American Indian Navajo, creation in Dine Bana. Now moving in the other direction, individual works by creative poets also become primary sources for awakening spiritual awareness and cultivating religious sensibilities. The epic tradition, Homer, Virgil, the Middle Ages, Bernard Silvestris, Alain de Lille, Dante, Milton, all of them make religious revelation explicitly their business. I think the most ambitious poetry is by its very nature religious, in the sense of trying to tie all things together, religare. This still holds true, I want to suggest, even in the famously accursed French poet Maudit, particularly Baudelaire and Paul Verlaine, among the founding figures of modern lyric tradition. Poetic claims and tones continue to be asserted in the 20th century avant-garde manifestos of Futurism, Marinetti and Dadaism and Gauval, and Stefan Georg's modernist religion of art, as declared particularly in his manifesto poem, Die Dichter in Zeiten der Viren. T.S. Eliot's Wasteland is spoken by Tiresias the prophet. Hugo von Hofmannsthal's attempt to create a spiritual nation through writing, the Schriften als geistiger Raum der Nation. Of course, this goes on, and you make your own list. The general point here is that poetry, both sacred and profane, demands to be understood as called forth by some higher agency than that of the poets themselves. Poets are the intimates of the gods. Orpheus is given his lyre and taught to play it by Apollo. There's some sort of a heavenly inspiration, or perhaps madness, with a higher transcendent source of consciousness. And yet poetry is also generally deemed to be a free, creative production of human beings, whether it's choral and collective in nature, or a highly personal form of lyric self-expression. The artistry of language as poiesis is crucial as well to this hybrid of poetry and prophecy that I'm trying to describe, the self-conscious crafting of the work, and even technical means from the lyre to the electric guitar have been employed to facilitate the visitation of the gods in Apollonian or Dionysian guises. And I think that we have to take seriously rock concerts as festival events, releasing the energies that put people in contact with an ecstatic reality. So that's part of this history. Texts explicitly claiming to deliver divine revelations have generally been highly and even consummately poetic works. The Quranic Surah, the Vedic Sruti, Buddhist Sutras, along with the sacred scriptures of many other religions. And conversely, then the highest and most sublime works of poets. It's these two registers of meaning and expression that in principle belong to different categories and even to disparate spheres of reality, the human and the divine, that come together and provoke critical reflection. I think we need to be able to shift our focus flexibly back and forth from religious revelation to poetic creation, from poetic invention to theological disclosure. Poetic form is indisputably a crucial aspect of theological revelation. It's frequently ensconced in myth or imaginative narrative and is embellished with ornamental rhetoric, musical meters, lyrical flourishes, and emotional transports. We find all of that in the source text that I've mentioned, under the sign of inspiration, and that word straddles both the religious and the aesthetic semantic registers. I think this is really at the heart of the entire conference, the idea that the divine is revealed in and through the power and the event of the poetic word. Religious revelation proves to be an inextricably linguistic event. Now, the reflections that I want to offer you consider the synergism between poetic expression and religious revelation. On the one hand, poetry has its origins in sacred rites and is best understood as originally a form of religious practice and expression. But through a process of secularization, songs and stories and other imaginative types of composition become detached from their originally religious context, such as festivals, where they are employed in ritual performance. They come to be recited in profane settings and are then transmitted as autonomous works and as objects of appreciation for their aesthetic value. This is clearly the case with mythopoetic works of Greece and with the Vedic myths and narratives of India. Poetry emerges as an art from originally cultic employments. Just as, in moving the other direction, then poets, in the wake of Dante, I would suggest, deliberately reverse this process, and they aim to turn their poetic creations back into a form of ritual expression and divine revelation, or at least a supranormal perception and preternatural visionary awareness. They do so increasingly from the midst of the secularized cultures of the modern world. Poetic form, as it takes shape in rhythm with its hypnotic cadences and rhyme or parallel verse structure, belongs to the earliest testimonies of human expression in most cultures. It's traceable to the sacred origins and cult practices of music and dance. Think about the very vocabulary for prosody, the foot of a verse of poetry. That is a dancing foot, and the verse itself, versus, the turning, is part of a sacred choreography as well. This was suggested by Nietzsche in The Birth of Tragedy, out of the spirit of music. It cost him his chair in philology and perhaps even his sanity. It was strongly rejected by the philological establishment of the time. And yet, it proves to be true, and still, I think, is being discovered more and more in its power. The cultic origins here of poetry and literature, he's talking about Attic tragedy, but I think it can be generalized far beyond that. Now, it's also this cultic aspect, I believe, of poetry combined with revelation that enables pagan culture to be taken up into Christian tradition. The Oracle at Delphi, with its Pythia or priestess of Apollo, as well as the Sibyls at various sites in the ancient world, like Cumae, delivered their prophecies typically in hexameter verses. Christian writers adopted these sources of oracular revelation as pagan precedents for the prophetic revelations of the Bible. Such ancient oracles were implicitly baptized early on in works by classical Christian poets, Lactantius, Prudentius,
Later on in the Renaissance, one still finds the five symbols of the ancient world on the vault of the Sistine Chapel, alternating with the Hebrew prophets as they look towards the last judgment. They really are taken on board, even St. Augustine, with all of his theological rigor against the ancient world, recognizes the symbols. There are massive infusions of prophetic lore from Hellenism into Christianity. Ephrem, the Syrian hymnographer, the Cappadocian fathers, Greek patristic rhetoricians. I think it's the fact that these were poetic works that enabled them to be brought along when pagan religious cult was condemned. Nevertheless, one could salvage these poetic predecessors. And it comes to focus on Virgil, of course, as the central figure of the pagan poet, thanks largely to Dante, but long before Dante, he was recognized. The fourth eclogue, right, the messianic prophecy taken as such by medieval theologians. There's also, in the fourth century, this Christian cento composed by Faltona Prova that assembles fragments from Virgil in such a way as to make them retell the biblical narrative from creation to flood, followed by the gospel story. All of that was in Virgil already, according to this hermeneutic, which is fundamental to the whole Christian tradition through Dante. And medieval dream visions, Pearl, Piers Plowman, even Chaucer, incorporate the same kind of a hybrid classical and Christian inspiration for their otherworldly apocalyptic visions. But this is all a literary tradition, and I really want to widen our focus even more to consider the background in magic and divination before we have literary testimonies. Although, of course, we all have to rely on literary testimonies like the massive order of Zauberspruche. I think it's maybe 9th century in Old High German. Gives us these incantations, which were certainly at the origin of German literature in this case. The common song comes from charm. Enchantment is a kind of chante, canere. Poetry is to be understood as originally a sort of musical charming or word magic. I think we have vestiges of this still in even the nonsense verse of children in authors like Lewis Carroll, Edward Lear, E.E. Cummings. And even the child magician's hocus pocus, right, is a reminiscence of hoc est corpus meum. These ancient religious rites still live on in our poetry. This forgotten prehistory of poetry is still echoing. Now, poetry makes it possible for us to think and feel in correspondence with an unknown and unspecified surreality created by negation in language and through the infinities opened up by indeterminacies in the employment of words. And that a lot of nonsense poetry summons that up to mind. It's this indeterminacy of poetic language that has been underscored especially by postmodern criticism and theory. Now, even in our post-magic world, in our secularized world today, we have some sense of the what Levi Strauss calls the l'efficacité du symbolique, the efficacy of symbols, or Freud calls die Allmacht der Gedanken, the omnipotence of thought. This is very often invoked by poets, at least in a subjective sense. It can be real for our experience as human beings. We pretend. The lyrical verses, optatives, and apostrophes still work their beneficent or maleficent effects just by pretending to induce things in the outer world to comply with human wishes. Things can be made to conform at least to the intentional representations of an inner world. Lyrical forms, for example, through their use of apostrophe, even apart from and subsequent to their pragmatic application in cultic and religious rites, retain, in vestigial guise, their original character as magical formulas used with an intention to symbolically transfigure and thereby to transmute the real. This can be made more plausible for modern readers by identification of the spiritual powers invoked with the poet's own agency. Shelley implores the Wild West wind to make me thy lyre, even as the forest is. His words become the embodiment of the spirit he invokes and enjoins. Be thou spirit fierce, my spirit. Be thou me, impetuous one, addressing the Wild West wind. Drive my dead thoughts over the universe like withered leaves to quicken a new birth. And by the incantation of this verse, scatter as from an unextinguished hearth, ashes and sparks, my words among mankind. Be through my lips to unawakened earth the trumpet of a prophecy. The poetic word has a tremendous power to reshape and revolutionize at least our human world. This power can still be considered magical, especially in its relation to the unknown, its capacity to evoke the unknown and surreal. Even in post-romantic and highly disenchanted times, poetry persists in remaking the world through acts of linguistic magic and sorcery. For example, Rimbaud, Les Voyelles. There's a verbal alchemy that many poets follow in Rimbaud, some of them. Or Rainer Maria Rilke, taking inspiration from the mystery cult figure Orpheus as prophet and as the forefather of his poetry. In one loosely cohesive lineage, romantic to surrealist poets were wont to practice poetry as a kind of conjuring of the unknown. And this is du Baudelaire au surrealisme. Now, these features of poetry are vestiges and reminders that in their most remote origins, poetic compositions were integral to cultic practices of singing and dance. They're dedicated to the gods and offered in prayer, typically as appeasement or in pleading for some kind of favored treatment or protection. Festivals, for example, the Pythian Games, held in honor of Apollo every 8 years under Mount Parnassus, and celebrating the victors in athletic contests, were ways of seeking to establish fellowship with the gods. And even speaking in the gods' own voices. Of course, when we take this to be metaphorical, Vico enables us to understand all of our language, actually, as metaphorical in its origins. His poetic logic and poetic metaphysics, I consider to be very helpful for understanding poetry as a divine art, ars divina. And this is really the tradition from Dante to Vico that enables us to see how poetry comes to found and ground a comprehensive cosmic knowledge, a philosophia perennis and a theologia mundi that far surpasses wisdom and importance the merely rational understanding of logical truths. And of course there are many forms of Gnosticism, from Valentinus to Jakob Böhme, that also, I think, pervade this kind of a supernatural knowledge through poetry. But what I really want to focus on is the epic tradition. This has been a background for understanding what is really happening in the epic tradition of poetic prophecy. The term revelation itself, I think we have to understand somewhat more broadly than strictly in the so-called revealed religions. It embraces philosophical and artistic phenomenologies of revealment, there's a kind of revelation in, or disclosure, or illumination in our poetic traditions, and prophecy as well, as has been noted repeatedly in this conference, is not really only about foreseeing the future, but rather seeing deeply into the overall meaning of history and the cosmos. And you know, the prophet is the one who speaks for God. Now, the Christian epic tradition, which I am going to turn to here, is based in many ways on Virgil. I think I should say just a word about Virgil's type of prophecy, which in many ways is analogous to Christian typology, or to typology in the Bible. Because it's when Aeneas receives the prophetic revelation of the future, of what's going to happen as a result of his mission to found a new civilization, right, moving from Troy, Traslatio Imperii, to Rome. The revelation is really of Roman history for Virgil, for Caesar Augustus, but it's presented to Aeneas as a future to be accomplished. This is the way in which prophecy enters into the present with an appeal. It's not saying simply what is going to happen objectively. It is imploring and enjoining the agents of current history to act worthily of their forebears. In this case, Aeneas is the archetype to be imitated by Caesar Augustus. In order to realize this dream of Rome, is Roman history going to be the bloodbath, right, leading to senselessness, or is it going to be the triumph of universal peace under the Pax Romana? That is still weighing in the balance. It's still to be determined. And prophecy is really about catapulting us into action. Right? It takes place in this dimension of time where past, present, and future are open to communicate with each other. We have to reactualize the past by reaching forward, anticipating the future, making it real now. That's crucial now to the Christian prophetic poetry that Dante inaugurates and passes on to Milton and Blake. And what I really want to focus on here is the German speculative tradition from Klopstock to Hölderlin to Novalis and some other German romantics as the deepest theoretical probing of prophetic poetic discourse. In this lineage, bringing together biblical with classical epic tradition, the work of Friedrich Gottlieb Klopstock, in the 18th century here, is seminal. Klopstock's epic poetic work, Der Messiah, together with his five religious odes or hymns, and his reflections in his theoretical texts, offer invaluable insights into the nature and purpose, as well as the means of poetry as an instrument of prophecy. They are foundational for another major axis of prophetic poetry passing through Hölderlin and Novalis, Rilke, Stefan Georg. Klopstock explores in detail aesthetic reflections, the ways in which poetry can become the vehicle of theological revelation. The phenomenology of the negative experience of incommensurability, of not being adequate to the experience of God, or more exactly, the experience of God's difference from us, figures prominently in Klopstock's understanding of the aesthetics of the sublime as what alone enables us authentically